Welcome to Mind Your Manners. Today we have Brent Bailey, Aloysius Lacomas. Am I pronouncing that correct? Lochomas.
Brent.
Okay. Excellent. And Rick, where are you putting the syllabic emphasis on that?
My name's pronounced as easily as it's spelled, Ivansek.
Okay. Excellent. Rick Ivansek, welcome. First timers to the show. You guys are doing some Harn writing in this quarter's Harn Quest. So we're going to be digging into that, what it's been like writing for the team and transitioning from being a fan to writing something that's officially canon. Brent, I'd like to start with you talking about these three articles. We have Pillar of Fire, Gimmon, and Bwaft, Gargan Colony. Why don't you take us through kind of just the overall plan for this quarter and what these articles were kind of intended to be and what they've shaped up into. And owing to the fact that Andrew, who wrote the Bwaft article, could not be here today, I'd like, if you could speak on his behalf for that one. So I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, as I think I've said in, in some past episodes, that there is very very infrequently a plan for a Harn quest. The plan of what goes into the Harn quest is usually what's ready. What articles has the team been working on that are at a point in development that they could reasonably be completed in the amount of time that we have, because we really try to stick to that quarterly schedule. So this one actually turned out a little bit different than than where it had been, even say a month and a half ago. Things changed a little bit, but and I know Rick, we'll let Rick talk a little bit about Gimmon and his journey through developing it. But I knew Rick and I've been corresponding about the article for some number of months. And it was like at the end of the previous quarter when that Harn Quest came out. And I was kind of scrambling to see, well, what do we have that can be done in 3 months now? And I had seen drafts of Rick's article, but it was actually before we had Rick as part of the team. He and I had just been kind of corresponding kind of off to the side. Similarly, Aloysius and I had been for a number of months, we've been kind of corresponding off to the side about some things that he's been working on. And in this case, it was like, all right, looking at where Rick is with Gimmon compared to other things other people on the team are working on, this one's much farther along than some of the other ones. So I was like, we're bringing Rick on. We're going to finish this article for the second quarter. Up until maybe a month ago, maybe not even that long ago, Pillar of Fire was not going to be in this Harn Quest. It was actually going to be something else. And that article was taking longer to be done. And Pillar of Fire has pretty much been ready to go for a little while now. But Aloysius has been developing that. Typically, you've seen like when we did a couple Harn quests ago, where we had Order of the Fuming Gate, Order of the Copper Hook, and High End Keep. We in the past have tried to publish the Clerical Order, Fighting Order, and Principal Settlement together in a Harn quest, and that had been the plan for Order of the Pillar of Fire, Companions of Roaming Doom, and Arketh Keep. That has been the plan, was that we were going to publish those together. But since Aloysius is the one who's working primarily on all three of those, clearly one was going to be done before the others and all that. But in this case, we had a gap of 10 pages that needed to be filled when the other article was clear that it was not going to get done in time. And I had it sitting there. So it's like, all right, we're pulling Pillar of Fire, off the off the bench, and we're sending it in now with this Harn quest. And so there was no plan. There was, up until 3 months ago, it was nothing. Then it was like, well, I think we can do this, and how about this? Bwaft was one of them that I think we talked a bit about this before when we did Huxeth and Ushet, Gargan colonies, that There are a handful of these colonies that Columbia Games had published in other publications 30 plus years ago. And we are trying to kind of bring those back into to get them back on the market, essentially, and to bring them up to the current level of our specifications with color illustrations and color maps and all that. So Andrew had been working on BWOFT because we had just done another one, and now I'm blanking on which one it was. I might have been Huxley that I'm thinking of. So he had been kind of figuring he would do BWOFT as well, so he had started working on that one just on the same model as Ushet and Huxeth. So that one was kind of a, all right, that one we can have done by, second quarter. And then it was like, oh, Rick's got, 18, 20 pages here that's pretty ready to go, so let's throw that in. And then it was the other one, and dropped it for Pillar. So that plus, I do want to not forget that we also, as we've been doing the last couple Harn quests, this one does include two Atlas Harnica map squares that are this time M9 and N9. So over your left or right below your left shoulder, carry the island of, yep, no, other way.
Right there.
Your left. No, other
This
side,
one.
that one right there, down at the bottom, the island of Meldoran and that area right there. So there's two squares right there where M9 has the little bit of the top of Meldoran Island and the Solora Wilderness area. And then N9 is the northeast part of the island and those big islands off to the side, which is ICOM. And some other ones in that. So those are the two Atlas maps that are part of this. And we're closing out or getting close to finishing all of Meldoran. We're pretty close to, I think we've got one square maybe remaining in Meldoran, and then we're done with that kingdom, which is going to be a big step. So yeah, so three articles, two maps, and one thing that is interesting about this one is that we do have a good mix of, we have a feudal settlement in the Kingdom of Candace, so way over on the west. We have a Gargan colony, which is kind of north central, and then we have a clerical order, which is also based over on in Western Harn, but it's a good kind of, they're not related. But it's a good mix of different types of articles this time. And one other really interesting fact about this particular Harn quest is that it is, I believe, the first time that we've ever had two articles by brand new writers in one Harn quest. And so that's been an interesting aspect of this, is kind of bringing two people onto the team and kind of getting them integrated with the way that our process works. And getting these two articles out.
Excellent. Yeah, and we're gonna chat about those in a moment. I want to stick with you, Brent, because you're Andrew's proxy today. Andrew Boyan wrote the BWOFT article, however we want to pronounce it.
Yeah, it's.
This thematically ties in with some of the recent releases, Huxeth, most prominently. But yeah, tell us a little bit about this. What's the elevator pitch for it? And
Sure. It was, back in 1997, Columbia Games put out a collection of called Nasty, Brutish, and Short, which was about the Gargan or the orcs of Harn. And there were four colony articles of the 20 something. I don't even remember how many Gargan colony there are, but there were four kind of sample ones. And BWOFT was one of them. And so it was one that had been kind of out of print for many, many years. And so now we're back in. So most of the writing, or half of the writing in this, was actually taken from the original article. So Edwin King, who wrote the material back in the 90s, and then Andrew, with a lot of input from a number of different people on the team. That was a really interesting thing in this one, was that we're kind of like, all right, how do we make this place interesting? What do we, based on what Ed King wrote years ago, but how do we flesh it out? Because one thing that I'm having a bit of a problem with as we've been doing these Gargan colonies is that there's a lot of similarities. So how do you make them stand out from each other? What's unique about this one? And so a lot of different people on the team contributed ideas to let's really focus on this aspect here. And then Andrew kind of wrote some text around that, and I wrote some text around that, and just kind of came together to put this thing to put it together. But the elevator pitch for, oh, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I felt like this was definitely the most unique colony we've had yet. So it's good to hear that that's kind of like the focus here. But yeah, let me turn it back to you for.
Sure. Yeah. In the previous or previous before that, Harnquest, we did Huxeth Gargan Colony, which is one that sits on the pilgrimage trail between Orbal and Arrakka Kalai. And so Ilvarin pilgrims travel that regularly. And it's a pretty rough route. It's through the mountains and all this. And right next to the trail, pretty much, is the colony of Huxeth. So it's a very dangerous thing. So Boft is just a little to the northeast of that. It's a little farther off the trail, but in the same kind of geographic area. And the thing about Boft is that a couple of years ago, the Gargan from Huxeth attacked it and have essentially not annexed it completely, but they're demanding tribute. And so you've got this Gargan colony, and these are the Gargu Ayani, which are the white orcs. So they're typically live at higher elevations in the mountains than the Hyika, which is what the Huxeth Gargan are. So they're living in kind of not completely alpine, but at a bit of a higher elevation. And actually, one of the things here is that it's at 5,900 feet above sea level. This colony is the highest permanently settled location on Harn. This is the highest one that is permanently settled. So it's kind of up there. And so you figure the food supply is already going to be somewhat limited. And Gargan are carnivorous. They're not, so they don't grow crops. They're just eating what they can catch or eating what they can breed. They've got they keep some livestock, that sort of thing. But now with Huxeth demanding tribute, a lot of their food is now being stolen or redirected to Huxeth. So these guys are struggling. So that was kind of what we chose to kind of focus on is what can they do? What are they doing? How are they reacting to this new pressure? The new political demands of, being a tributary to a stronger colony. Are they going to try to fight back? Are they going to just knuckle under? What are they going to do? And so that was kind of a lot of the new material was around the situation that really kind of puts them in a bind. And, we threw in some other things as well to even make it more of a struggle for them. But that was kind of the elevator pitch is it's really a colony that is struggling to keep its head above water. And what are the PCs, if they come into contact, how do they factor into that? Because that was one of the things with the Gargu Kayani are, as Gargan go, not as bloodthirsty as some of the other subspecies. And so you could theoretically see PCs allying with the Gargan of Boft to fight the ones at Huxeth or what, so it's not just a we're going to go in, we're going to kill what we find, we're going to kill the bad guys and steal their stuff. It's more than that. It's actually they're It gives GMs a little more flexibility or more opportunities for some interesting interactions with orcs that may not have, come up before.
Yeah, this felt like the most dynamic set of, let's say, personalities among the Gargan that we've seen yet.
Good.
And the way it hooks the players in, you can run Garden Colonies just as like a dungeon and, an opponent and stuff like that. This really mixes it up with possibilities for the GM to put in front of the player. It's not one dimensional, which I think is very interesting because, it's like, well, do we want to ally with these guys? We could do some damage to Huxith. If we're running some sort of Illyrian Trail type campaign and, Huxith is raiding that, then we run with that. We also have let's some Ivashu that are very interesting. So there's a lot of gold nuggets in this one. I really liked it, and I like the I'm not going to spoil it, but I'm going to say there's a fantastic poetic map on here that in some ways reminded me of Calvin and Hobbes hand-drawn map from the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, one thing about that map is that if you went back to the 1997 Nasty Brutish and Short, there was an adventure that was written to kind of go along with BWoP, and a map was part of that. And there was a map that was included. And, Richard Lushek, our artist, had stated early on that he really hated that map, that it looked too computer generated, but it was, and other people said the same thing, that it was way too accurate, that it was just kind of a rough drawing of the real map, and with rooms clearly labeled as to what they were and in relation to other maps or other rooms in the complex. And it was too easy. And like Richard said, that this isn't what someone who had been there and escaped would have drawn. That we need to have it so that it's usable, but not as accurate, not as complete, not as accurate. And that's what he's done, And so he's done, I think, a really good job of labeling the rooms with little drawings, not, they're, because his thinking was, that what language would it be in? And, is it who drew it and how they drew it and all that. So he illustrated it and put labels on that are essentially just symbols. And I thought he did a really good job of it. And he was really pleased with how it came out. How he drew the Gargan Queen, I think he said was, his favorite little symbol there. So yeah, it turned out really well. And we've been trying to do a little different things like that with some of these Gargan colonies, where they're, I think Ushet had a map that was drawn in the Kuzan or Dwarven style. And then the last one, Huxeth, there was some debate as to whether it was, did an orc draw this? Did a pilgrim draw this? Who actually drew this? Because it's on a skin. It's just, scratched onto or painted onto a skin. So yeah, we're, I think that we don't want them all to be the same. And so we're trying some different things here. And Richard's really good at coming up with new ways of conveying that kind of information.
Yeah, it was fun. It's the last image in the article, and I was just like, oh, this is a great way to bring it all together. So, excellent. Well, let's transition here. Let's go talk Pillar of Fire. We're gonna move west if you're going counterclockwise or anti-clockwise for our friends across the pond. Aloysius, welcome to the show. Happy to have you here.
I don't think I ever decided on like what their gesture would be. I feel like this is what they would do. Is this
So,
too Islamic? Yeah, this is nice pillar.
our Pillar of Fire.
Yeah, because they
This is
did.
a cool one. Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
Because they did start out as evil Buddhists, which they radically changed since then. So I think that would probably be very appropriate.
Evil Buddhists. There's a pitch.
That became their backstory, essentially, with the Eightfold Death. But yeah, let's.
Yeah, we have that cycle of rebirth built into their tenets of belief. take me through this. What was the elevator pitch for, you know, another Agrican order here, fleshing this out and digging into it?
Well, it actually started as the Companions of Roving Tomb, because a Harnmaster game I was running at the time set out of a Tarkane, and it was, you know, naturally naval because island. And one of my players wanted to play an Agrican knight, and I was like, well, you're not going to really have any opportunities to ride a horse. Kind of tough to, you know, store on a naval vessel. So I was like, I needed to find some sort of Agrican fighting order that would reasonably have the ability to have some knowledge about being on a ship, fighting on a ship, and also could go off on mercantile and piratical adventures across the entirety of the Western seaboard. And the Companions of Roving Doom, what little was there, hit on that perfectly. And then after that, I went, well, crap. Now I have to make up everything. And I was just, I don't remember exactly where, but I was just sort of vaguely talking about how I'm coming up with these ideas because I have to do something. And Brent was there, asked me about it, liked my ideas, and it went from there. Pillar came first because ultimately, and this is something that the writing team generally has been working towards more recently, and in particular, I like, because it's regarding the theology, the sort of metaphysical, scholastic justification for the religion. And that's been like a failure of a lot of previous articles. Like, for example, the Mamakans. As much as I love them, they're great, they're wonderful villains. They're wonderful villains, and that's about it. And sort of, they didn't really have a strong justification for why they believe the things they do. And that was sort of what I wanted to figure out first, because from what their moral beliefs, their ethical philosophy, their sort of theological view of things, what is the point of life? Why are we doing this? From there, I could then figure out the Companions and sort of why do they believe what they believe. I took what little nugget we had from Gods of Harn, and I had to like, okay, so they're vaguely populist, whatever that means. And they were very powerful, but not so much now. And they have an enemy in the Mamakans. So I had to kind of work backwards. I had to figure out what would the Mamakans hate? Well, they would probably hate something, which also led to my very minor contribution to the colorization of Order of Mamaka, because I had to come up with a theological justification for the Mamakans to hate the Pillar at the same time. So basically, I had to hit on a number of points, namely, why do they believe what they believe? And I wanted to sort of give them a bit of a stronger backstory. The Herpans and the Mamakans, and by extent, the eight demons, they have like a connection in, you know, previous Agrican orders from the Karani Empire. And I wanted to maintain that. But I wanted to do a little bit something different, because those were very esoteric, very high-minded secret societies. I wanted more ground level. I wanted to sort of draw upon a sort of, not a common man's religion, but something that could be more easily grasped by people.
Yeah, the note I have here is a bit of a grounded order for the Agricans, which is exactly, you know, how it reads. So I would say you succeeded really well in that.
Well, because the Fuming Gate was also being written at the same time. So I did take a bit of inspiration from them. I'm like, you know, I can probably take a lot of some of these ideas, like Fenric of Marskir. That was something that I came up with. I'm like, I want to kind of connect this to the continent as well, because things don't just arise ex nihilo, and having like a strong sense of history, I think grounds things a lot.
Yeah, and the last, when we talked before about Hyann and the Fuming Gate and all that, there was a little concern that I had that Fuming Gate and Pillar of Fire have a number of similarities, and because they were both the two orders that are the most like grounded, the ones that aren't as esoteric in their beliefs as some of the others. So we were, because both of those were kind of in development at the same time, you know, there was coordination there with what Mark Renop was doing with Fuming Gate, and what Aloysius was doing with Pillar of Fire, was to like, well, we want to kind of tie them together in some ways, but we also need to differentiate them, because that has been, you know, if you look back in the just at what was in Gods of Harn, the original little blurb of information about each of these orders, there wasn't a lot of nuance. Everybody was, they were just another flavor of bad guy. You know, it was just a very kind of black and white. So we have been, over the last few of these orders, we have been trying to add some nuance to the Agrican religion overall, and to each of these specific orders, as to they're not just there to give yet another adversary to the GM. But if you think about these as, well, they're real religions, well, how are they different, and why do they exist? Why does this order believe what it does? And like Aloysius said, that this hasn't always been the case with how these orders and the religion were kind of portrayed in canon. So we have been trying to really add that to make these guys stand out, because, as I was saying about the Gargan colonies, they kind of run together over, you know, if you do one after another. So you've got to have something that makes them different. But that was that plan of making all the Agrican orders different has been there from the beginning. But those early ones, it was less focused on what do they believe, and more focused on what do they do. And but without really that putting in that thought, that philosophical or theological backing to why they do what they do. So that was there, but it wasn't as highlighted. And so we're really trying to kind of bring that and expand more on that in some of these, in these that we're doing, because it really is going to come down to, we now have, just after Companions of Roving Doom, we will have two pair of orders left. We'll have the Kukshin and Crimson Dancer up in Orval, and we'll have the two orders that are involved with the Pamazani Games. And that one I'm super looking forward to,
You
because
are
that's,
forgetting about another pair. You are forgetting about the Vihran and Black Claw.
yeah, I was talking mostly just on Harn, but yeah, the ones that are up in Ivinia, we'll get to those as well. But you know, it's, we want to make sure, but that by the time we're done with the ones that are involved in Harn and Ivinia, that they're all very easily identifiable, very easily differentiated, but at the same time, that they have realistic ties and realistic reasons or rationales for any antagonism. So that's really kind of what we're trying to do. And you know, as you found here with Pillar of Fire, it, I think we did, you know, this was, I was really happy with where this came out, because it started, like Aloysius said, with just a little bit of information. Now, in when we did the Kingdom of Wrethem module, Carrie Mold has been planning to write these two orders in Arkath for many, many years. He had kind of taken a lot of notes of what he, where he kind of saw them, and a little bit of that got worked into the Kingdom of Wrethem article. So the idea of the Companions of Roving Doom as the as marines, as you know, having ships and being able to project themselves into various, you know, various locations in Wrethem relatively quickly by water, that came from Carrie Mold. So that, you know, full credit to Carrie there for kind of coming up with that idea and putting that into the Kingdom module. But then that's what Aloysius had seen, where he was like, oh, great, that's an aspect of these guys that I can really build on. And so that was just one part of this order, or you know, the Pillar of Fire and the Roving Doom. But it was kind of taking what's out there and just, all right, now how do I make these guys of a believable group?
Yeah, and Aloysius, you did a great job making them believable. I think you could easily, very easily, have player characters, you know, as members of Pillar of Fire without them needing to feel evil, which I think is the win, right? Because none of these folks see themselves as evil
Well,
straight
yeah,
up.
I wanted to ultimately, like, my issue with fantasy generally, because I'm a person just kind of generally concerned with philosophy and religion and whatnot. So I wouldn't quite call it a hobby. It's a little bit more important than a hobby, but it's something I think about. People don't just believe things because it's convenient. They believe things because it speaks to them at a fundamental level. And I was thinking, what the hell is there in Agricanism or Morgathianism for that matter that appeals to a person? I can understand Nevaeanism. A lot of people like weird austerity. I don't get it personally, but there are people. But like, how do I make the Agricans more interesting, more compelling? And I was like, I would say the probably primary religion, not religion, inspiration for a Pillar of Fire was what were aspects of religions, but I really reached for a lot of 20th century, 19th century political philosophy and try to take that, mold that into a religious thing. Like a lot of focus on like, all right, so here's your role in society. At the time when Fumingate and Pillar of Fire were being written, I had sort of taken a view. I don't really know if Mark took this view at the time, but it sort of helped me find my differentiation. Was the Fumingate, they're like objectivists, they're like libertarians, they're like the individual strength, discipline, personal stuff. But the Pillar of Fire, they're collectivists, the collective society. We're building a society, everyone for the collective. You're in your role helps society. You can change your role, but the role's the important part. I think it really helped them feel more believable because they see themselves as having a place in the world. They're not trying to bring about the apocalypse. Their view about recreating the world and Mon Rashush's image is not like literally lighting it on fire, like some ridiculous Forgotten Realms villain. But more of a metaphorical destruction where we're gonna have a society. It's gonna be really nice, very orderly. Everyone knows their place. Yes, we will be lighting people on fire, but that's you gotta have your hobbies.
But one thing that really made this challenging was that this order is active not just on Harn, so not just in a feudal context, but it is also active in Ivinia. So you've got it, one of the things that we had to do here was, okay, Aloysius, you've come up with this kind of idea of what their philosophical, theological underpinnings are. Now, how do we manifest that, not only in a feudal context in Wrethem, but also in the quasi-Scandinavian context of that the civilizations up in Ivinia? And so those are two different things. They're, a person in Wrethem, a person in Ivinia have different outlooks on because they're just culturally different. So here you've got an order that's active in two places. So how do those beliefs manifest in those two different contexts? And so that was just from a structural perspective on putting together the article. If you look back at some of the other clerical order articles, there's a pattern to what we covered. Well, here it's like, well, you can't make a generalization about what the current situation is because the current situation is different in two different places. They're organized very differently. They're one is very on the descent because they've been essentially almost wiped out by another or by the Mamikans. But in Ivinia, they're on the ascendant. So it's how do you take that and write it in two different contexts but keep that common underpinning there. And I thought that was a real challenge that we had, but again, was very happy with how this came out.
Yeah, I think it's a
The more challenging the writing, I think, if you accomplish it, it's just that much better.
And also got to shout out Richard for some excellent artwork in this one as well. The depiction of the eightfold principles there, the eightfold rule rather, is fantastic. So Rick's been waiting super patiently.
I'm sorry, Rick, but I love talking.
You're fine.
Rick, we're gonna talk Jimin,
Okay.
if that's how we're pronouncing it.
That's how I'll be pronouncing it.
So this is your debut article. We have a 14-page settlement in Kandae. Tell us about Jimin. Jimin.
Okay, well, how far back would you like me to start?
Let's actually talk present day, and we'll tie it back.
Okay. Well, when I started the article, it was based on my current campaign, basically. The Baron is the father of Ja'an, who is also appears in the article. He's basically the leader of our PC party. There are two other characters in there very briefly as well. Cradlin's adopted daughter, Carissa, is also a PC. And Alwine, the daughter of the Smith, is also a PC. But I read an awful lot of historical fiction as opposed to fantasy. So I tried to create Gimmon to feel more like a real feudal manor settlement. That's why it focuses on personalities and things of that nature. When I drew the map initially long ago, I was reading a archaeological survey article on a tidal mill. And there was no tidal mills on Arn at the time. So I thought, well, this would be interesting. So I added that into the article. That also kind of led to the salt panning added in. I don't know what else you'd like to
No,
know.
it's a really cool setting because it's in the aftermath of this big storm that basically just broke the economy locally, right? Like
Correct.
destroyed all the fishing vessels. And so you've got this new political entity that's running the town who's come in and he's revamping it. Hasn't really panned out yet, so there's going to be some conflict there, right? But we have this beautiful illustration to kick things off on the article by Richard of the salt works. And you can see me in the bottom left-hand corner. I'll flash that on the screen here. But it is not modeled after me, but I strongly identify with this guy. The overall feel of it is kind of unique because what tends to happen when you get a fantasy setting is like everything's kind of just working, it's in motion. Here we're in the aftermath of kind of a ecological disaster, right?
Correct.
So we have a lot of folks, like if you're playing a Leah Kuvare type character, this would be a good place to get in because anytime there's downswing in your economy, good possibilities for smuggling and things like that. We also have the cult of Aedir, which is a nice little touch in there.
What's interesting is that when I was adding more into the background, because this wasn't even really something that was initially in the drafts I was using for running my campaign. That was a small footnote in, I believe, the Kingdom article, or no, the Kingdom article at the Cult of Adir was sort of prominent in the area. And I thought, wouldn't that make a wonderful reason for the storm? And if you look into the political background, you'll notice that the king installed the baron because there was turmoil within the controlling family and they couldn't produce a reasonable heir when the area was left vacant. They were angered by the fact that the king just picked up this guy and dropped them into their community to sort of sort things out. So there's an allusion to the fact that, well, maybe the Cult of Eder actually created this storm that was intended to make the Baron's life difficult and destroy the little community. And that was honestly kind of an afterthought.
That's okay. Afterthoughts are still great.
That
was one of the things with this article, was that, and I that with it, I think I mentioned this before, that with the when a new writer comes to the team, they often come with, I've been developing this for my campaign, and so how then do we make that more of a not generic, but more suitable for a lot of people to write their, to run campaigns around. So it's less specific, even though in this case, I was aware that at least one of the non-player characters was a PC in Rick's campaign. I didn't know about the other ones. And so, and I think that that's good because when you read this, it's not like, oh, well, clearly this is a PC in someone's game. It's not obvious. They're not the star of the show. That kind of thing. So, but at the same time, with this one, as Rick mentioned, that when he drew the original map for this, it was actually back in 2007 when Columbia Games put out the Interactive Atlas of Candae, which was just a set of maps for each of the keeps and castles in the kingdom. And there was nothing really about them. There was like a very brief key that had some of the, just a label for some of the important locations, but it wasn't really fleshed out at all. But the interesting thing was that if you looked at the map that was published in 2007 for Gimmon, but then you look at what the Candae Kingdom module said when it was released in 2009-ish, it's almost as if the people who wrote it hadn't looked at the map because there were some discrepancies between the text and the map that were a little confusing. And there was no mention whatsoever of the salt operation. There was no, and that was a prominent part of that map was the salt, the salt works, but the text didn't mention it at all. It didn't give salt as an export for the settlement. So part of what we had to do here was take what Rick's ideas were and try to kind of reconcile, well, we've got the map, we've got what Rick's new draft is, we've got this existing text. How do we make all of those true? And how do we then? So that was a bit of a challenge with this one, was this because the salt works is a big part of the article. But what we've done with it is, well, it's a big part, it's a new, it's a big part of the local economy, but it's a new part of the local economy. It's only since this storm. And so you've got a new operation. It hasn't yet. It's not yet making a profit. They're not producing enough for export. So all of the stuff that has been said before is still true, but we've now enhanced it by saying, yes, but what is the future going to bring? So it hasn't historically been an exporter of salt. But next year, in that chart of supply and demand, you could change that to a plus because now your Gaiman in the future, or Jimin in the future, is producing salt and exporting salt sufficient enough to, to do, to make, to be bringing in more money into the local economy. So that was, I think, a really good part, a good illustration of taking old sources, new ideas, making sure that they all work without invalidating something that was said in the past. Because we try to stick to, we're pretty, strict about staying tight to existing canon, but that doesn't mean that we're handcuffed by it when you can make it make sense in a way that other people may not have thought about.
And Rick, since this originated as like your in-play setting, did you find that kind of a hindrance? Like, did you have to really diverge to write the canon article? And I mean, do you contain two headcanons of what this is, the official and the game world at this point?
No, not at all. Because first of all, Brent's a marvelous editor, and he really did his best to make every work with me and make everything fit together. But I didn't. I went more into detail in the article regarding all the little idiosyncrasies of the town, the things that were there. For example, the castle itself wasn't actually fully developed probably until about a month ago, because these are things we never really needed in the game. So to finish the well-rounded article, a lot of the stuff that I created to make it a publishable article, I basically designed to fit the open space that agreed with everything. The history, for example, again, is a latecomer, and it was just through Brent's help and through searching through all of the existing documents, trying to just make everything mesh. It wasn't that bad. It really wasn't.
Excellent. Let's talk a little bit. We have like 20, 30 locations in the town, plus the sub-locations within the castle.
Okay.
There any that come top of mind that you want to shout out as like something that play that GM should particularly take a look into, things that you found most interesting that you hadn't had in your game that came out of
That I
this?
hadn't had in the game. Well, the castle itself, I think, is very well detailed. There's some details in there that allude to other things. There's a bed in one of the bed, I think it's in Cradlin's bedroom, that is there's something mysterious about it. That could be a hook. It might be connected to the Edder cult or something along those lines. We leave a lot of that open. The salt works themselves, they're run by a retired miner who has lead poisoning. He's actually one of my favorite characters. And he was given the position as sort of appeasement to the Miners Guild for them, because they're a huge political force in town because of the lead mines. And it's extracting salt from the sea or salt from the earth is I've always viewed personally as kind of a gray area as to who would have control over that. The Chalk Maiden itself, the is one of another one of my favorite things. It's also that was used in my campaign, and that's a latecomer to the entire area. But some time ago on it was either Facebook or on the bulletin boards, they were talking about the are there any chalk geoglyphs on Harn, and there hadn't been at that time. So I thought, Well, I could put one in my campaign. That would be great. And I created the Chalk Maiden. There was a session designed around it. And I got the idea from an old movie that actually I'm convinced the piece of art that probably everyone my age remembers when Harn came out of the Norman style knights coming through the village with the person hung in the tree and the villagers, upset that they're burning their settlement, whatnot, from the warlord. And there is a priest in the warlord that is kind of pagan, kind of Christian. And I thought, well, it would be kind of interesting if I took the Peonian priest in the village and made him sort of like that character, which is why he embraces the Chalk Maiden, because the villagers embrace the Chalk Maiden. It's kind of a symbol that they feel protects the village. So rather than try and erase that from their religious practices, he embraces it. As far as other things,
Oh, and like it can be anything. I didn't mean to really restrict you to things that weren't in your campaign.
no, I'm not. I just no. There's all sorts of things in the article itself.
Oh, it's a big article. There's a lot.
I mean, it's hard for me to draw on any one thing. I like an awful lot of
I can't imagine why.
No, I mean, I'll just say, like, I thought this would be a great location, because you've got access to the sea, you've got, the Kandae, we're Southeast Kandae, right? So we've got trade routes headed east. We could do, there's a lot you can do with this particular setting. You don't have to be on the front lines with the conflicts up north or anything like that. And then you have a dispossessed clan. There's
Yes,
plenty
the
of room for
Dalkeeds,
political.
yes.
Yeah, you have plenty of room for political intrigue here. I thought it was a very strong setting. I really liked it. And again, Richard with the art, fantastic job on the Chalk Maiden. Shout out to our map makers as well. And you actually got a map credit on this one, Rick, along with Bill Bean, who does most of those maps.
Yeah, because
Yeah,
like I
sorry.
said, Rick had drawn the original one back in 2007 for the Interactive Atlas of Candae, and then Bill took that and kind of redrew it using our current, using the current standard for mapping. It was the Interactive Atlas of Candae was all done using Campaign Cartographer software back in the, and so Bill just kind of replicated that using Adobe Illustrator the way that where the rest of ours with the our standard patterns and swatches and that sort of thing. So it's kind of Rick came up with the map and Bill executed the drawing of the map. And he did the floor plans too.
And it's I actually thought there was an active Humble Bundle for that software right now, but I don't see it anymore. But Campaign Cartographer goes on sale every now and then, so if you want to make your own Harm mats, that's
Well,
always
the
available.
problem was that back when, and Rick, you know more about this, I think, than I do, but there was somebody had done for Campaign Cartographer 2, they had done a packet of Harn colors, swatches, symbols, that sort of thing. And so it was easy for people to use Campaign Cartographer 2 to make Harn style maps. And then CC3 came out. And it no longer worked with the Harn packet of symbols and stuff. And so it's and as far as I know, it's never been updated where there you can't buy Campaign Cartographer 3 and easily make Harn style maps because that package no longer really works.
Bummer. Well,
Yeah, that was
we're
That was a very long time ago. It was published in 2007, but I want to say that it was drawn several years earlier than that. It's hard for me to remember exactly when that was, but it may predate that the that actually may predate that 2007 release by as much as 5 years. I don't, so
Have you been
yeah.
running the same campaign for 20 years at this point?
No. In fact, it's until I started this campaign actually 7 years ago, and I had never used Yemen before, and it was still just a collection of notes. And so I figured, well, I drew the place, we might as well play there. So that's where we started. So it
Excellent.
was the first time I'd ever used it, actually. So what is that? Almost 20 years later.
Well, I do plan at some point to do kind of a GM's discussion type episode. Not talking about any particular products, just talking about running Harn. So I think Rick and Aloysius, love to have you guys on.
Oh,
Brent,
good
obviously,
God.
door is
Happy to
always
be
open.
there. Yeah. I have many things to say about running Harn and how it's very different than most other settings. Like that, the setting that I made, like the Pillar of Fire for, there was an abortive campaign. I'm like, this is going nowhere. I learned very important lessons. You gotta have very particular vision. You can't just futz around. A lot of campaigns before I ran that one, it was just sort of like, yeah, I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out. It does not work for Harn. You gotta know what you're doing.
Harn is very much its own thing in a lot of ways, which is what makes it so intriguing to me. But yeah, I don't know when that's gonna take place, but it will take place. I also plan on doing a fanon focused episode going through and exposing some of our newer folks that are just finding the setting and the game systems and all that, helping them uncover some of the best works that the community's put out. So,
Like esoteric Kvarism, first Harn work. Ed's, why do I keep doing religious things? I don't know.
a huge part of the Harn world. So, it fits. Well, why don't we call this an episode here? And I thank all three of you for joining us today.